Lecture 41, Dynasties 28 through 31, The Beginning of the End.
Hello again. Remember last time we finally had the Persians out of Egypt and we have an Egyptian on the throne again? Well, it's not going to last for long. Today I want to talk about, in a sense, the final decline of Egyptian civilization. It's a time when we'll see the last native ruler of Egypt on the throne. But first, let's look back just for a minute to see what's happened and what's led to this. Now, remember that Egyptologists, not the ancient Egyptians, but Egyptologists, divide Egyptian history into Old Kingdom, Middle Kingdom, New Kingdom, so it's manageable, so we can assimilate 3,000 years of history. Well, after the Old Kingdom, the era of pyramid building, Snefru the Great, all of that, we had an intermediate period, a collapse, which we call the First Intermediate Period. Then we saw Egypt rise again with the Middle Kingdom. Then we saw another collapse, the Second Intermediate Period. And then came the New Kingdom, the glorious New Kingdom of Amenhotep III and Queen Hatshepsut, Thutmose III. But then we saw the gradual decline. Maybe Ramses III of the 20th dynasty is the last great Egyptian king. We're now in a period that is called sometimes the Third Intermediate Period. It's not a great period, not a consistent period. And it started, if you remember, with the 21st dynasty, when the high priests of Amun started writing their names in cartouches. That was the start of the Third Intermediate Period. That's the beginning of the downward spiral. After the high priest, remember the succession of foreigners that ruled? Libyans would unite the country. Foreigners, right? And then the Nubians would come in. And then the Assyrians. And then we saw the Persians. And now finally, at the end of the last lecture, we saw the Persians leave and an Egyptian ruling Egypt. Today we're going to talk about four brief dynasties, concluding with the last native ruler of Egypt, Mekhtennebel II. There's very little to say about these dynasties. We hardly know anything about them. But when we're finished, what I would like to do is kind of look backwards and see what tradition is ending. What is this the end of? But let's start with Dynasty 28. Right? We have one king of this dynasty, Amenhotep. One king. He's really probably a prince in Sais, in the Delta. He calls himself king, doesn't even write his name in a cartouche. He really doesn't count. He's the 28th dynasty. That's it. Nothing much. Dynasty 29, they move the capital from Sais to Mendes. It's in the Delta, and there's a god of Mendes. It's a ram-headed god with huge horns, right? But we only have two kings of this dynasty, Nephrites and Acherus. Two. There's a little bit of an attempt to build something, perhaps, but again, nothing like the great kings of Egypt. The next dynasty, Dynasty 30, is the one that contains our last Egyptian ruler. It starts with Mekhtennebel I, right, who declares himself king. He's starting off a new dynasty. And during his reign, Egypt was invaded again by a combined force of Greeks and Persians. The Persians are becoming interested in Egypt again. Everybody's always interested in Egypt. No matter how bad the politics are, you've still got the grain. You've still got that wealth. So they invade Egypt. And I think it's almost by luck that they're expelled. Mekhtennebel first pushes them back. Two reasons. One is, I think, that they make a strategical error. They invade during inundation. when the water's all over the place. You know, so I have images of these Greeks and Persians marching through the mud, you know, getting stuck. They're not used to it. The other is, the Greeks don't trust the Persians, and the Persians don't trust the Greeks. So this combined force doesn't really get along. You know, sort of like, you go first, you go first. So anyway, Nectanebo repulses them. And he builds a couple of temples. It's really, I mean, it's fortitude. The Egyptians don't want to die. They've got a tradition. And he builds Egyptian temples. He builds one at Philae. Now, it's a little bit of an unusual site. Philae is an island. Now, that's unusual. You know, Egyptians didn't tend to build on islands. They like the mainland, right? But Philae is a beautiful, beautiful site. And Nectanebo builds a kiosk, a small temple to the gods, on Philae. He is succeeded by Jedhor, his son. But we're going to get a little bit of civil war here. When Jedhor is out of the country, his grandson is declared king, right? His own son turns against him and says, my kid is king, right? And Jedhor had to eventually flee the country. And he's succeeded by Nectanebo II, our last native ruler. And there's something to say about Nectanebo II. First, he returns to the old religion. He is trying to reestablish it all. Builds temples. He still has those granaries. He still has things to trade. He's got money. He's trying for a renaissance. Trying. He hired 20,000 Greek mercenaries to fight the Persians, right? He's going to lose. He loses that battle. But he is doing anything he can to keep an Egyptian on the throne. It's the last gasp. Take all the money. Hire these mercenaries. You may not even be able to trust them, but you're going to lose anyway. So he tries. It's a desperation measure. We have a few monuments left of him. The one I like the most is a little shrine. It was found in the Delta. It's a black basalt shrine. It's maybe 7 feet high. Inside, a statue of the god could be kept. It was placed in a temple. And it's dedicated to the god Soped, one you haven't heard yet. Soped, a late god. Soped is associated with the dog star Sirius, right? The astronomical star. And this is important for the Egyptians. It's important because that's how they reckoned their years. You see, New Year's started for the Egyptians when Soped starts rising in a kind of helix. And about the time that it rises on the horizon, the Nile overflowed its banks. Once a year, the same event. That's when New Year's started. For the Egyptians, this event occurred in July when the Nile overflowed its banks. And this, in a sense, this little shrine to the dog star, Soped, is a monument to continuity, to the Egyptian calendar. And I want to say something about the Egyptian calendar. You see, we get our calendar from the Egyptians. You know, you ever think about why do we keep 365 days of the year, right? That's an Egyptian invention. The Egyptians had three seasons. The first, inundation. It started with the Nile overflowing its banks, depositing the topsoil. That is season number one, inundation. The second was emergence. Emergence meant the land was emerging from beneath the water. It was the time you could start your farming. And the third season is what's often called summer. Shamu was the name. It just meant when the land was dry. When the land was dry. So they had three seasons. Each season had 4 months. So they had 12 months. And that's where we get our division into 12 months. Now each month had 3 weeks of 10 days each. It was a 10-day work week. Or a 10-day week. Actually, we have some of the workmen's records where one guy on the, they really got the 10th day off. One guy on the 9th day was given the day off to brew the beer so the guys could drink it on the 10th day. Right? So it's sort of a fast brew. But they had a 10-day week. Now, if you do your math, doing it now, it adds up to 360 days. 360. So it's not quite our 365 yet. It will be. Trust me. It will be. There was a problem with a calendar of 360 days. Now think about it. Just think with me. Think through it. Let's say New Year's Day is when the Nile overflows its banks. And this is an event that is in sync with nature, meaning it's going to happen every 365 days. So you've got your calendar of 360 days, and now you say, oh, it's New Year's Day. The next day is New Year's Day. After 360 days, you say, ah, New Year's Day is coming. But the Nile isn't going to overflow, is it? You've got to wait 5 days because it's in sync with nature. Now, every year, you will be 5 days off. Every 10 years, you'll be 50 days off. Right? Every 100 years, it'll have gone around, you'll be 500 days off, so to speak. And this actually happened in Egypt. Their calendar was so out of whack that sometimes they had to say, it was the month of emergence when the land was dry. Right? In other words, it was when the land was supposed to come up, but it was summer, really. It wasn't really emergence, it was summer, because it just got so out of whack. So the Egyptians added 5 days. They're called the epigonal days, the additional days. Right? They're added so that it would come back into sync with nature. And then you get your 365-day year. Those 5 days was party time. It was a blast. And it was dedicated to the gods. So they would be feasting, and everybody would have a great time. So our calendar comes from the Egyptians, and Necténabo II's little shrine is, in a sense, a shrine to continuity. Now, we have a couple of other monuments of Necténabo. We have his gate at Medinet-Habu, but we've also got a sarcophagus, black basalt sarcophagus. Right? It's in the British Museum. And it was called, when they discovered it earlier in the 19th century, they discovered it, it was called Alexander's Bath. Alexander's Bath. Now, why? It was called Alexander's Bath because it's found in Alexandria, near Alexandria, and it had holes drilled in the side of it. Now, it looks like a big bathtub. It's a big rectangular tub, so to speak. It's a sarcophagus, though, intended to hold the body of Necténabo. But sometime, maybe even in the Middle Ages, it was discovered, and people drilled holes in the bottom so they could plug it, fill it with water, take a bath in it, and then pull the plugs out and drain the water. It was probably used as a public bath. And many people called it Alexander's Bath because Alexander the Great bathed in it. That was the idea. And it's in the British Museum. If you want to see it, you can see the sarcophagus of the last native ruler of Egypt, Necténabo. Now, as I say, though, Necténabo hired his 20,000 Greek mercenaries, went to fight the Persians, and lost. Lost. He fled. He probably never used that sarcophagus. And where did he flee to? Nubia. Interesting, huh? Vile Kush, those Nubians, you know, that the Egyptians had gotten gold from somewhere. I think he probably fled there because he knew the Persians, they weren't going to go follow him. This was way, way south. So he disappears from history. And with him ends native rulers of Egypt. There's one interesting legend, and I'm going to get a little ahead of my time. As I said, I wanted to do a summing up, too. We'll do that also. But there's one medieval romance called the Alexander Romance. And according to this legend, Necténabo didn't flee to Nubia. No. He went to the Macedonian court. Right? To Greece. Right? As an Egyptian magician. Right? And he had an affair with Philip II's wife, Olympia. And you know who the child is, the result of that union? Alexander the Great. It's a legend. Obviously, the Egyptians put it out. But you know what? It makes Alexander the Great an Egyptian. They're still not giving up Egyptian rule of Egypt. Right? We're going to have, and as this is where I say I get a little ahead of my story, we will have, after the Persians finally are done away with, and I'll do away with them in about 5 minutes, after the Persians are gone, Alexander the Great is going to take over Egypt. And we're going to have Egypt ruled by Greeks. But the Egyptians just wanted to put in one last, it's really Egyptian, right? So the legend really has it that Alexander was Egyptian. But Nechnenabel leaves. He leaves. And the last dynasty, Dynasty 31, it's the Persian period. It's the second Persian period. They take over. But they don't do much. Artaxerxes, right? He comes in. Temples are sacked. The treasures are all taken. But he was an absentee king. Wanted to go back to Persia. And he's poisoned in Susa. Right? He dies. Poisoned in Susa. Arses the next. Another absentee king. He was murdered. Right? It's a habit. And then Darius the Third, the last of this dynasty. It is his governor of Egypt who is going to open the doors to Alexander the Great. But that's going to come later. Next time. What I'd like to do now is look back. We've seen the death, or at least the fleeing. We haven't actually seen the death of the last native ruler, Nechnenabel II. I want to try to show that the history that comes up to this point is not a history of separate pharaohs, one after the other. That it's really one big piece of cloth. That it's a tradition that is going to end with the pharaoh, really. Egypt still had so much money that it'll keep going. It was like a company that had such wealth that you couldn't kill it. It'll keep going. And it'll still look a little like Egypt. But it's really going to be quite different. And let me try to explain why, in a sense, Egyptian history ends here, in a sense. Remember way back when we talked about Egypt as the first nation? Remember? We talked about Narmer, the pharaoh who comes and unites Upper and Lower Egypt and becomes the first king of Egypt. Well, from the time of Narmer on, the pharaoh would be the symbol of Egypt. Egypt was pharaoh-centric. The pharaoh's job was to maintain Ma'at, divine order. And divine order was with Egypt on the top, ruling the Middle East. And remember that there were three things in Egyptian society that had to stay the same? The role of the pharaoh, the military, and the religion. Egypt had tried to keep this in balance. It was a balance. Three things. Priests were wealthy. Military was strong. Pharaoh assured it all. The military rode out, brought back booty, gave it to the temple. The gods looked upon the military. The military rode out again. And the pharaoh made sure it all worked. Right? This is the story of Egypt for almost 3,000 years. Remember the intermediate periods? During those intermediate periods, they always went back to a pharaoh. That was the role. That was the government that they had to have. And when people like Nechnenabel were fighting to keep Egypt Egyptian, right? He knew these traditions. They were written on temple walls. It's harder for us to read them. But Nechnenabel could go into Karnak Temple, walk through there, and see the exploits of Thutmose III. He could see this, he could see that. It was all one to them. This was their tradition. One of the things, and the last thing that I'll tell you about Herodotus, our man, because we're now past the time of Herodotus almost. He wasn't around when this happened. One of the things that amazed Herodotus, he said, when I came to Egypt, the priests took me into their temple, and they showed me statues of generations going back and back and back and back of priests. He couldn't believe that you could have such a long history. Couldn't believe it, because the Greeks were newcomers compared to the Egyptians. So it wasn't just isolated pharaohs. They were fighting for a tradition. This was ancient Egypt. And let me take as an example, just one example of how it didn't just happen. It was 3,000 years of development. The Book of the Dead. Because we're not going to see Books of the Dead now. They're going to really die out. The Book of the Dead, you'll remember, I've mentioned it many times, was the guidebook to the next world. This was going to assure your resurrection in the next world. How did it evolve? Where did the Book of the Dead come from? Well, go back to the Old Kingdom. Go back to the pyramids. And remember, the last king of Dynasty 5, Unas, is the first one to have pyramid texts. He inscribes on the walls of his pyramid, in the burial chamber, the first large body of texts in the history of the world. And they're all magic, and they're all determined to get him to the next world. That's the pyramid texts. Now let's trace them through a few thousand years of history and see what happens to them. And you'll see, Egyptian history is like one piece. Remember what followed the Old Kingdom and the pyramids? First intermediate period. The pyramids are robbed. They're robbed. Now think about this. The pyramids are left open. Tomb robbers break in, take whatever treasures are inside the pyramids, and the pyramids are open. For the first time, the commoner can go inside a pyramid and see what it looked like. There are no guards anymore. This is the first intermediate period. They go inside the pyramids, and what do they see? The pyramid texts. And they read them. They have someone read them to them, perhaps a priest who's still around. And they learn. These spells will guarantee your entry into the next world. They'll get your resurrection. Now everybody wants them. They're not just for the king anymore. Now you've got people wanting resurrection just like the Pharaoh with their spells. But what do? They don't have pyramids to put their texts on. These aren't people wealthy as pharaohs. What do? They write them on their wooden coffins. And we now get, after the first intermediate period, a new development. It looks like a new development, but it's the same old thing twisted around a little bit. It's the coffin texts. Inside wooden coffins of the Middle Kingdom, we get commoners having the pyramid text, basically the same text written inside their coffins. And they're beautiful things. Sometimes they're painted rather elaborately, rather beautifully. And they're just to help them get to the next world. Now, that's the Middle Kingdom. So notice, the coffin texts of the Middle Kingdom are really the pyramid texts of the Old Kingdom. But we've not yet to our Book of the Dead. Remember, we're trying to explain why the Book of the Dead is not just something that pops up. It's a development. Eventually, somebody realizes, probably a priest who wants a business for himself, somebody realizes that we can't fit all the spells inside a coffin. It's just a rectangular box, maybe 6.5 feet by 3 by 2, maybe. What are you going to do? You're missing some crucial spells. Maybe you won't have your legs in the next world. Maybe you'll miss out on your arms. So somebody comes up with the idea. Let's write it on papyrus. We can put all 280 spells or whatever on a papyrus, roll it up, and you can put it in your coffin. That's the Book of the Dead. The Book of the Dead is the development from the pyramid texts to the coffin texts to the Book of the Dead. We're looking at 2,000 years almost. It's a continuous thing. It may be on papyrus. It may be on wood. It may be on stone. But it's really the same thing. When a nobleman of the 19th dynasty or the 20th dynasty had a Book of the Dead placed in his coffin, he is going back to the Old Kingdom and the pharaohs who had pyramid texts. So this is a tradition that the Egyptians were very much aware of. Very much. And this is the tradition that's about to die. Even the tradition of the gods. For 3,000 years, Egyptians worshipped the same gods. And the gods were an integral part of their life. For example, haven't talked about them, the god Beth. Wonderful god. He is the god of both childbirth and war. Both. Right? Strange? He's shown as a little dwarf. Sometimes he's banging on his tambourine. Pretty gleeful guy. Sometimes he's got a sword above his head. Right? He's the god of both childbirth and war. Now, women would have amulets of Bes for a good childbirth. Integral part. By the way, Bes is unusual. I'm a little side trip. Bes is unusual. If you look at the carvings of gods on temple walls, you will notice that virtually every Egyptian god is shown in profile. You never get to look at a god full face, head on. He's never staring right at you. There are only two deities in ancient Egypt that you will ever see looking straight at you. One is my man Bes, the little god of childbirth and warfare. Some people think that this suggests that he was a foreign god. He's a strange-looking guy. You know, he has a tail like a lion. He has a mane like a lion. But he stands up on 2 feet like he's a little dwarf. He's a dwarf. It's a combination of dwarf and lion. But Bes was an integral part. Women would wear. I should tell you the second one. I know I said there are two that are full face. I'll tell you the other one. It's Hathor, goddess of love, music. She is shown the face of a beautiful woman with the ears of a cow, right? She nurtures. She gives milk. She suckles. And sometimes if you look on the top of her head, you will see a little rectangular temple-like structure. It's really a sistrum, a musical instrument, a rattle-like thing, which was a sacred musical instrument that priestesses of Hathor would rattle in the temples. Right? Now, Bes, god of childbirth, there were, of course, thousands of gods in ancient Egypt. Right? Bes wasn't even the only god of childbirth. Think about Taweret, another one of my favorites. She's a pregnant hippopotamus. She's standing up. She's got a big belly. And Egyptian women would love amulets of Taweret to protect them when they gave birth. But the point I want to make about these gods is that Egypt worshipped the same gods for thousands of years. Thousands. Osiris and Isis. They were all worshipped, all part of their daily life. And who were the ones who made sure that the gods were worshipped? The priests. The largest bureaucracy in the history of the world. And this is something that is going to die in Egypt with the death of Necdenabo II, the last native ruler. Because priests don't contribute to the economy. They take it. They don't create goods. They don't go out to war. And when you get foreigners coming in who are going to control your country, they want it to be an efficient company. They want to get all they can out of it. What we are going to see in the next 4 or 5 lectures are Greeks ruling Egypt like a business. Take all the money you can out of it. And if you're going to really rule Egypt like a business, you're not going to support the priests. And when you don't support the priests, you're going to lose something else. Not just the gods, no. You're going to lose the language. You're going to lose the Egyptian language because the priesthood was always the literate class. So when we have the last native ruler fleeing Egypt, we are going to have the beginning of the end of the Egyptian language. Egypt for 300 years is going to be ruled by Greeks. None of whom, virtually none of whom, speak Egyptian. Greek will become the language of Egypt if you want to do business. And the priesthood is going to die out. Till eventually, the sacred Egyptian language, the hieroglyphs, will become a dead language. There's only one exception of the Greeks ruling Egypt. Cleopatra will learn the language. Cleopatra. But she's still 300 years off. Where we're going to have to start next time is with the beginning of the Greek period, with Alexander the Great. And we'll do that next time.